is a download from Triple J.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture, triplej.net.au.
And now...
Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, Dr. How are you, Dr. Zan?
Very, very well. Excited about jumping into another hour of Science Talkback. You're here till midday today, and that means that, Nation, it's your time to give us a buzz. There's one line free. Hop to it, 1-300-055-36 if you've got a question for Dr. Carl. And, of course, if you've got any answers and you can't get through, you can tweet him at DOCTORKARL or text us 1975-7555. Are we ready to ramble into some science questions?
Ramble to ready.
Okay, Lexi's calling in from St Kilda East. Hi, Lexi, what's your question?
Hi, doctors. I'm just wondering, why are some people more susceptible to motion sickness than others?
Mm. Complicated. Even fish can get seasick. If you get some fish and you put them in a tank and you take them from one island to another, you can find the contents of their gut littering the bottom of the fish tank. You can get seasick on land. For example, Lawrence of Arabia was prone to seasickness when travelling around on the ships of the desert, the camels. And you can get seasick at sea. There are a few different ways that you get seasick, but the bottom line is that there's a mismatch between what your eyes are seeing and what your body is expecting. So, for example, if the horizon is going up and down, you see it going up and down, but the ship is also corkscrewing, then your balance centers are saying, there's a mismatch. Ugh. Now, you have three ways of telling where you are, at least. The first one is your eyes. You know, you need your eyes to tell you which way is up and you don't fall down. The second one are the well-known balance centers in your brain. They're just right near to the ear, wrapped in very dense bone, and they're basically sort of conceptually like little tiny bones inside a chamber that's lined with hairs that are all pointing towards the centre, and it's sort of like if the bone is resting on one hair, then it says, well, that weighs up. And then the third system is your joints. Now, this is really surprising. Think of a big, long room, and you're sitting in a big, long room in the dark, and at the other end of the room is a light. And somebody says, put your arm out and point at the light. And so you put your arm out and you point at the light. And then they grab your arm. If they move your arm in a clockwise circle, you'll see the light going anti-clockwise. Whoa. So the point is that different people have got different amounts of how well-wired their central brain they are. And I'm lucky because at this stage in my life, I am totally not seasick. I used to be when I was younger, and it could change. Like next year, next time I go to the Antarctic, I could get seasick again.
Well, that's the thing. I used to get motion sickness in cars when I was a little kid, but I seem to have grown out of it. Can you grow out of it, or does it just come and go with it, you know, as age happens?
You can grow into it and out of it. Think back to the little chamber in your ears, which has got a bone, a little tiny bone, a ball, resting on some hairs. Suppose that with time, that changes from being a circular little ball into a ball shaped like a peanut shell. Suddenly it's pressing on two sets of hairs. And people at any stage in their life, they can be 20, 30, up to 90, they can wake up one morning and they stand up and they fall over and they vomit. And it's a terrible thing that happens. So, you know, you're lucky to be alive. So does that kind of answer your question about motion sickness, that it's complicated and it changes and you might be motion sick this year but in 2 years you might not be, and vice versa?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I've always wondered, I've always suffered a lot myself. But I also am curious, is there a link between static electricity and motion sickness?
No, I haven't heard about that one. If somebody has, can you please let us know on Twitter? And one cure that is probably one that works fairly well is either the beloved truth serum of black and white Nazi movies of World War II, scopolamine, give the patient the scopolamine, or number two, far easier, ginger.
Yeah.
Rolled hippie ginger works surprisingly well.
Thanks for the call, Lexi.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lexi.
Paul's calling in from Woodcraft. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Dr. Paul.
Paul, are you there?
Paul?
Oh, we've lost Paul.
Oh,
we'll see if
I
we can
like
get Paul.
Paul
back, and we will bring up instead Bridie in Darwin.
Hello, Bridie in Darwin. Welcome, Dr. Bridie. Welcome to the show.
Hang on a minute. Is that Bridie in Darwin?
Yes, it is.
Hello, Bridie. What's your question?
Good morning, doctors. My question is about vinegar and whether it's an alkaline or an acid.
It's definitely an acid. It's called acetic acid. The formula is, I think, CH3COOH. And I think if you look up in Wiki the definition of an acid, it means that when you chuck it in some water, it gives up hydrogens. It makes H pluses. It's definitely an acid. It's definitely not an alkaloid. I can say this without looking up Wiki. I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
Almost.
Thanks for the call, Brady. Mark's calling in from Melbourne this morning. Hi, Mark.
Hey, guys. How you going?
Very well. What's your question?
I just wanted to know how migratory birds know which way is north and south.
Good question.
A bunch of ways. They navigate by many different pathways. They can hear infrasound, the sound of waves beating on beaches from hundreds of kilometres away. They can even tell the polarisation of light. So when they're in a whiteout, where you have mist, where the sun is somewhere but you can't see the sun, where you have no shadow, they can tell where the sun is by looking for polarisation, and they have little tiny magnets in their brains. Look up a guy called Joe Kirschvink, K-I-R-S-C-H-V-I-N-C-K, at Caltech. Hello, everybody at Caltech. And he was a guy who discovered that there are tiny magnets in our brains 20 billionths of a metre across. Now, you're saying, well, hang on, if we've got these little magnets in our brains, how come we can't navigate using magnets like the birds do? Well, as the actress said to the bishop, if you don't use it, you lose it. And, hey, can anybody here in the audience even remember the phone numbers of their closest five friends? Or do they just hit Fred or Amy on the telephone? So if you don't use your magnetic sense, you lose it.
That's interesting.
Thanks for the call, Mark.
Thanks for that, too.
Hey, we found Paul in Woodcroft who dropped off before. We have him back. Hello, Paul.
How you going, Dr. Dan, Dr. Carl?
Very well. What's your question, Paul?
I've got a question about how they calibrate degrees Celsius. I would assume that it's calibrated from boiling point and freezing point at sea level and then just divided into 100.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the case, obviously atmospheric pressure affects that calculation.
Yep.
I would actually, would that, as we're pumping more gases into the atmosphere, carbon and stuff like that, would that actually increase, that would show an increase in the mean degrees Celsius in the calibration of it?
There would be a slight change. It'd be slow, so tiny, but it's real. It would be so tiny that it'd have to be picked up only by the sort of instruments that you find in calibration labs, in testing laboratories. But yes, there would be a change. The scientists have a special term, which is STP, standard temperature and pressure. So they simply define that if you get water at the standard temperature, which I think is 20 degrees C, and the standard pressure, which is 101.1 hectopascals per cubic second per square furlong per nanometer or whatever it is, that if you then get water and turn it from a solid into a liquid and then into a gas, in that intermediate stage you've got 100 degrees centigrade, divide that temperature by 100, that's what you're going to call your degrees C. I think that's how they do it.
So that wouldn't be... small increase wouldn't actually be giving sort of extra credence to the increase in temperature that we're seeing and blaming on global warming.
Oh, no, global warming is real. It's caused by humans. We did it. It's going to get worse. And wait until the next IPCC report, when, for the first time, they start accounting for positive feedback loops. Until now, they've been very conservative. All their predictions have been pulled back so that all of the scientists are happy to sign off on it. But now they're happy to start adding in the positive feedback loops and wait for them to come down the line and start getting a bit of a shock further down the line.
Hey, thanks for the call, Paul.
All right.
Thank you, Dr. Paul.
All right, we're talking science with Dr. Carl. 1-300-055-36 is the number to call if you've got a science question. He's with us till midday today. Dr. Carl is with us and we are talking science as we do every Thursday. Don't forget that if you've come in halfway and you've ever missed out, you can catch up on the podcast, which is found very easily at triplej.net.au, or call us because he's with us till midday today on 1-300-055-36. Meg's called in from Hobart this morning. Hi, Meg.
Hi.
Hello, what's your question?
I was just wondering why people get deja vu.
Oh, that's tricky. The standard explanation, which is not entirely correct but close enough, is that you have the vision that comes from your eyes being interpreted in two different ways. One gives you this full wraparound glorious 3D thing, and that takes 0.3 of a second from when it lands on your retina to get to your brain and then into your consciousness. And a lot can happen in 0.3 of a second. A killer kangaroo could come around the corner and rip your guts out. And so there's a little fee that comes off the line that comes out early on and it does very shallow processing and it just looks for something that's a threat. So you are continually processing the optical feed to the back of your head for danger and continually throwing it away. And you're always looking at it and throwing it away, and it's a faster feed. It, like, it comes out in, say, 1/10 of a second. We think that occasionally this sort of bleeds through into your consciousness. So you come around a corner and you see a car, but you thought, but your quick feed saw that, you know, 0.2 of a second earlier, and you think, I knew the car was going to be there. That's the standard sort of theory. But if you're Uri Geller, you think that it happens because you can see the future and you're just always so cool that you can tell what's going to happen before it happens.
And you can bend spoons.
Oh, well, there is the secret to bending spoons is very straightforward. Bend it when no one is looking, unquote.
Thanks for the call, Meg.
That's all right.
See you later.
Thank you, Dr. Meg.
Laws is calling in from Townsville this morning. Hi, Laws.
Hey, how are you, Dr.
Laws? Welcome.
Very well.
Very well, Dr. Laws.
My question is, why do some people sneeze 3 times? Why do some people sneeze 9 times? And does it have anything to do with sensitivity in the sinuses?
The sneezing pathway is very important because it's a way of throwing stuff out of your airways. You've got to keep breathing all the time. So it's wired in. There's a specific pathway. And when I was studying neurology, I actually went to the trouble of memorizing this pathway. And it was about 3 pages, and I immediately forgot it. Along the way, because it's wired into you, some people, for some unknown reason, are wired in that they will sneeze 3 times or 9 times. So they never will just do a single sneeze, no matter what the stimulus is, whether it's smoky air or a bit of food stuck down their airway, they'll always sneeze whatever they're pre-wired to. Why? We do not know. We do not yet have the information to understand the DNA enough to know why we do this. But we'll find out further down the line, 10, 20, 30 years, we'll probably find out. But at the moment, we don't know why.
Thanks for the call, Laws.
Interesting. Okay, thanks a lot. Hey.
Cheers. See you later. Josh is calling in from Brizzy today. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well. Are you on antibiotics at the moment?
I have been, but I'm not anymore.
And what is your question relates to things that you shouldn't do when you're on antibiotics, doesn't it?
Yeah, I want to know why doctors say not to drink while you're on antibiotics, because I have this debate with people that I believe it's because for some reason it cancels it out. And then other people say, oh, no, because when you drink alcohol, it makes you drunker. And so, yeah, I want to clear that up.
Dr. Carl.
Well, firstly, there's always this hint. There's always this search for the thing that'll make you drunker on the same cost and quantity of alcohol. I don't know why. Sure, the obvious answer to that is to have a few drinks at your parents' place where the alcohol is free and then go out. Number two, with regard to the myth that alcohol shouldn't be taken with antibiotics, yes, alcohol can interact, and sometimes quite nastily, with a small, I emphasise small number of modern drugs such as tinidazole, which is phasogen, and metronidazole, which is Flagyl, and it can give you nausea and vomiting and abdominal cramps and headaches and fast heart rate and flushing. And alcohol can reduce the absorption of other antibiotics such as the doxycyclines and a few of the tetracyclines. But these few interactions are well known to both the medical doctors who prescribe it and the pharmacists who give it to you, and they will tell you this. In general, alcohol has nothing to do with antibiotics. It either makes them better or worse. And it all began with penicillin, which was the miracle drug. It worked quickly and effectively against pneumonia, meningitis, hundreds of other deadly diseases, and against what were then called in the old days VDs, venereal diseases, now called sexually transmitted diseases, STDs. Back then, in the 1950s and 60s, the VD clinics, the blue light clinics they were called, they gave the very somber and serious advice that alcohol should absolutely never be given, never be taken while you're having penicillin, even though they knew that there was no chemical or pharmacological reason why. The real reason they said it was for moral reasons, not pharmacological reasons. They were worried that the alcohol would reduce your inhibitions, who, while under the influence of alcohol, you might get a little frisky and then pass your infection, which hadn't been fully treated, to another person before the penicillin had had a chance to cure the sexually transmitted disease in you. You could pass on to somebody because you got a little bit disinhibited, we might say. So that's how the myth conception that alcohol should never be taken with antibiotics arose. Does that kind of answer your question, Dr. Joss?
Yes, it does. Excellent. Thanks
for the call, Josh.
Thank you.
So is it true that even with certain antibiotics, say antibiotics that sometimes have codeine in them, when that sort of, when that's combined with alcohol, that's not a good idea? There's no truth in that?
Hang on, wait a second. We're talking a separate thing now, whether you should have alcohol and codeine. They're two different drugs, and really, it can work sometimes. In your body, codeine gets turned into morphine, and it comes in, I think, three levels. You can either have 8 milligrams, 15 or 30, and I've just read a paper the other day which said that anything under 30 doesn't count, but I reckon it does help a little bit. But having that with alcohol, look, if you're in pain and if it helps reduce the pain, do it. Pain does not make you a better person.
All right, let's get a call from Stephen in Canberra this morning. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning, doctors.
Good morning. What's your question?
I have a space shuttle question, actually. I've been watching on the internet some space shuttle launches, and when they take off, they're at 100%
of thrust.
Thrust, and then they're at that for some time, and then they reduce the thrust down to 70% and enter into a period called maximum dynamic pressure.
Yeah.
And then they get through that period and then thrust back up to 100%. And I was wondering if you could explain what maximum dynamic pressure is for me.
Look, I don't know. I'm going over there, and I think it's roughly around 4:16 p.m. on the 26th of February next year, give or take 5 seconds, roughly, where I'm going over. And yes, I've already hired my car, sports car, two-door sports car of the type that the astronauts normally run on, no names mentioned. And maximum dynamic pressure, I think, refers to the fact that they may be passing, I'm guessing here, but I think it's to do with the structural integrity of the space shuttle. They may be passing through sound barrier, Mach 1, Mach 2, whatever it is, and the pressure waves on the space shuttle could damage it.
Okay.
And I think that's what it is. I don't have access to our good friend Wikipedia, so if somebody could Twitter us in an answer, that'd be ever so thrilling. I think it's related to that. I do not know. I could be wrong.
All right, we'll see if we get an answer for you,
okay,
Stephen. It texts us in 1975-7555 or maybe tweet Dr. Carl at DOCTORKARL. I'm sure someone can help us out. Thanks for the call, Stephen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stephen.
We've got a call from Ben in Morty Alley. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how are you, doctors?
Very well. What's your question?
Look, when I look into the curved part of a spoon, why am I upside down? And I'll flip it around the other way, and I'm the right way up.
Okay, the answer comes from a field called physical optics, and what you have to do is get a pencil and paper and draw what's called a ray diagram. And if you draw the rays that go from, say, the top of your head and bounce into the spoon, when you look on the inside, they end up down low. But when you're looking on the outside of the spoon, they end up high. And that's about all I can do without pencil and paper. You've actually got to do a ray diagram. And if somebody could tweet in a homepage that would do that for you so you could see it on a bit of paper, on the internet, on Wikipedia, whatever, that would be just a glorious thing.
All right. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
It's had me stuff for days.
All right. Keep listening. We'll see if we can answer for you.
It's a difficult one, Dr. Ben.
Yep.
Thank you, Dr. Ben.
Thanks for the call.
Cheers.
Thank you.
There you go.
Dr. Carl's joining us 1-300-055-36 for the next half hour. What am I talking about? Dr. Carl is joining us here at Triple J. 1-300-055-36, the number to call. We are talking science. 1-300-055-36. On the line, we do have the sounds of who do we have this morning? Dominic in Brisbane, are you on the line?
Hello, Dominic in Brisbane, Dr. Dominic?
Oh, no, possibly we have, hang on, let me just figure out who we have on the line. Dr. Carl, I am trying to find them. Line 3 is who we have.
Hello, line 3. Are you line 3, sir, or madam? Dr. Line 3? And here we go.
Dominic.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi,
sorry
Dominic.
About that,
How
Dominic.
Are you
today? What's your call?
I was just wondering why, because people say that AM radio is the stronger frequency, but if you go into like a parking garage or underground or something like that, AM always drops out, but you can always still hear FM.
You go back to the old engineering thing of swings and roundabouts. AM has a longer wavelength, and so out in the open, it can bounce off the various layers in the upper atmosphere, and so you can hear the capital city of another state at night somewhere else. So in Brisbane, you can probably hear New South Wales. In New South Wales, you might be able to hear the Adelaide ABC antenna at night. Now, that's the good side. The bad side is that the long waves don't like to go around corners. That's where FM comes in good. The FM is line of sight, and so it's limited to 50, 80, 100 kilometres in the open air, but it can go around the corners in parking stations, so you get better reception as you dive down. So it's not that one is stronger or better, but they just have different limitations, different strengths and weaknesses. Does that sort of answer your question, Dr. Dominic?
So AM kind of bounces up where FM's straight to it.
Yeah. Well, AM will bounce and will go in straight lines and will bounce over the horizon. And in fact, you can sometimes pick up powerful radio stations from other parts of the world. And I remember one time I was driving across the Nullarbor. My wife had flown home because she was heavily pregnant. We were coming from Perth back to Sydney. And I was driving across the Nullarbor and there were no radio stations. And I was in the very slow vehicle. I had a top speed of 80 kilometres per hour. And I was chundling across. And then on the AM radio, I could suddenly pick up a very powerful Christian radio station in South America, in the Andes. And it started to compare Jesus to every trade. And it started off, well, once there was a man, and he had this woman, and he got a knife, and he cut open her belly. Well, he was good because she had a tumour, and he fixed it. And Jesus is like that. Jesus will cut the sin out of you. And then compared Jesus to the carpenter and the plumber and everything else. So AM can travel huge distances depending where, as FM is limited to line of sight-ish.
But not through concrete.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dominic.
Thanks for the call, Dominic. We have Tony from Maroubra on the line. Good morning, Tony.
Morning, Dr. Carl, Dan. How are you going?
Very well. What's your question?
My question is just regarding like the moon landing and the conspiracy theories behind it all and everything. To sort of clarify it all, why don't we get like one of the massive telescopes down here on Earth or like the Hubble telescope that can see into different galaxies to actually just point towards the moon and see if we can see the flag or any of the other debris left behind by the astronauts?
The angle is too small. The spacecraft left on the moon, and certainly the flag, are way too small to be seen from Earth. However, if you go looking on the internet for LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Observer, and that was a spacecraft which, I think earlier this year or late last year, was put in orbit around the moon with a big fat telescope. And it's actually picked up every single one of the American landing sites. And so if you go to LRO, NASA, moon photographs, put that into your Google search engine, you will see the spacecraft that have been left on the moon. With the next generation of telescopes, we'll then be able to see the various flags.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Tony.
Got it. No worries.
Thank you, Dr. Tony.
We've got another sort of space question. Well, definitely a space question from Guy in Windsor. Hello, Guy.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well. What's your question?
My question is, if all of the planets apart from Earth were to line up in sort of a direct line to the sun, including Earth, what sort of effect would that have on the gravitational field of the planet Earth?
Luckily that was supposed to have happened on, wait for it, 05/05/05. The 5th of May 2005 was supposed to be the day when all the planets would line up in a straight line and there would be mass mayhem and destruction, or perhaps we'd all line up and love each other very much, or perhaps we'd have a little art and trade fair in the corner while watching the angels come from above and the new planet Nibiru come around the corner and see us.
Yeah.
At that time, on the 5th of May 2005, the planets did not line up in a straight line. In fact, they were scattered over 90 degrees, and I think there were a planet or two on the other side of the sun. Now to answer your question, if all of the planets were lined up in a straight line, straight out from the sun, Mercury all the way out to, we'll even include Pluto, if they were to do that, the effect upon you, the gravitational effect, would be less than the gravitational pull of a fully loaded jumbo flying overseas over your head at 30,000 feet. In other words, so close to zero, it'd be not even worthwhile considering.
Yeah,
so when the people say that when all the planets line up, we'll have a new rising of consciousness or mass destruction, they're lying to you, I'm sorry.
Makes sense, Guy?
Yeah, yeah, you know, it does, certainly.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you, Dr. Guy.
Nathan's no on the line from Berwick. Thanks so much for staying on the line, Nathan.
No problem.
Thank you, Dr. Nathan.
What's your question?
It's on hydrogen, which I know chemistry isn't your weak point, as you said last week.
Definitely.
Chemistry isn't your strong point.
Yep, go on. you're dead right. I'm weak on chemistry and geology. I'm so weak on geology, but lay it on us, Dr. Nathan.
Okay. Why is hydrogen so flammable, yet when combined with oxygen, which is needed to make it explosive, when bonded, why doesn't it catch on fire, yet instead puts out fire?
Well, because it's already been burnt. Now, think about some paper. Paper, we can just forget all of the hydrogen, oxygen, think of it as carbon. You get the paper, you burn it, and then you're left with the ashes. You can't burn them again. It's already been burnt chemically. We're not talking about nuclear burning, we're just talking about chemical burning. With hydrogen, you burn it, you mix it with oxygen, you get off energy, and you end up with the ashes, which are called water. I mean, they're wet, but they're still the ashes, in inverted commas. It's been burnt. All the chemical energy has been taken out of it. And the way that water works is that it covers the fire and it excludes the oxygen. It stops the oxygen from getting there, which is the necessary fuel. And the water could absorb heat from the fire as it gets turned from liquid water into steam, and that cools down the fire. So it works that way. There's not enough energy in the fire normally to split the water into hydrogen and oxygen. I imagine that if you could get it to a really high temperature, it might be possible, but in normal house fires, forget it. The only way we can normally split water into hydrogen and oxygen is with electricity.
Okay, I asked a few people. My science teacher didn't know. Asked my dad and a friend. They both said it was bonded, so kind of got a different answer to what I was expecting.
Well, they're all slightly correct. It's a very big and complicated topic, and because it's already been bonded, you need energy to be put in to break that bond. And the crude energy of a fire, blech, not quite good enough.
Thanks for the call, Nathan.
No problem.
Good on you, mate. Nathan. Ben's calling in. Not sorry, Ben. Ashley's calling in from Box Hill. Good morning, Ashley.
How are you?
Very well. What's your question?
My question is, I listen to a lot of like hard dance and trance and more recently dubstep. And that music, there's a lot of highs and lows and all that sort of stuff. Sometimes, you know, might have had a hard day at work and you just get in your car, put on your favourite song, turn it up, and then when it's getting to the climax of the song, or when it reaches the climax of the song, you just get like that shiver through your body, you know, up around your back, around your shoulders, your neck. So kind of like a skin orgasm.
Ah. Like a skin orgasm?
Yeah.
Yeah, I want one of them.
Also known as when the music kicks in, Dr. Carl.
Kicks in, man. Yeah.
Why does it happen?
Look, there is a guy. What's his name?
Daniel Levitin.
Daniel Levitin. And he's coming on our fabulous show when?
In a couple of weeks. Around middle of October.
Yeah. Now, this guy has written not one but two books on exactly that. Now, you've ever had that thing where you hang around, you don't feel like dancing, and then suddenly a particular song comes up and you want to dance? He's the man who knows the answer. He knows the answer to your question, and he'll probably be able to tell us about why it is when you're playing loud thrash-type music, you are more likely to go through a red light. This does not mean that you should switch off Triple J when you're driving in the car and put on easily listening FM 104.4, whatever it is. No, but nevertheless, he is the dude. And he'll be on in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, this is a guy to listen out for in around the middle of October. He's written a great book called This Is Your Brain on Music, which covers exactly this and all the reasons why our bodies and our brains react to certain things in certain ways when we hear certain sounds and particularly the music that we love. So, Ashley, he'll be able to answer your question in a couple of weeks' time. So listen out for that. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Dr. Ashley. Dr. Carl's with us till midday. Just a few more minutes to spend with you as we talk science with Dr. Carl here at Triple J. And we have just a couple more questions to go. Josh in Penrith, you're up next. Good morning, okay. Josh.
Good morning. I've got a question about absinthe.
Yeah.
Hit us.
Lay it on us, man.
I work in a bottle shop, right?
Yeah.
And I have people coming in all the time asking me for absinthe, which makes you hallucinate.
Yep.
And I keep saying to them, mate, it's a joke, it's just a myth, it doesn't happen, you know, they want the wormwood, and I keep telling them wormwood won't make you hallucinate, and I was wondering if you had a definite answer on that.
Ah, absinthe was called the Green Fairy because of its colour. Yeah. Very popular in Paris, late 19th, early 20th century. Thought to stimulate the creative juices in a special way that alcohol did not. But the price was the disease called absinthism, involving terrifying hallucinations, epileptic attacks, insanity, and a word that I think we should all use more often, enfeeblement. Hi, I can't come into work today for I am enfeebled. Anyway, so the absinthism seemed to be totally different from what happened with alcohol, and so it was a separate disease and was blamed on the evil wormwood oil, which shrub belonged to the daisy family. Okay, the bottom line is this. The oil needs to be dissolved, the wormwood oil, and that means that the alcohol content can be as high as 80%.
Whoa.
Well, I've got one here that's 95, so it's pretty
ribbon. 95% alcohol is enormously high. Number one, experiments have been done with the wormwood oil. And yes, the wormwood oil is a hallucinogen, but to get even from, they've got bottles from way back then, to get enough wormwood oil into you to give you the hallucinations, you'd have to drink so much you'd be well and truly unconscious from the alcohol. That's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, there are nasty side effects from the absinthe, so that with regard to using the hallucinogen, so the difference between hallucinating and dying is very small. And thirdly, it was just the alcohol. Because you needed high amounts of alcohol to keep the wormwood oil dissolved, therefore the people were just having 95% alcohol instead of, like, the normal highest is about 50%, is it? 54?
About 45. The overproofs are about 57.
Yeah, that's right. So absinthe is in a whole different league, and there are absinthe lounges opening up. And what you do is you just go there. I've been to one in Sydney, and there's, I think, another one opening up in other capital cities. And you just go there, and you there's a whole ritual, and the woman wears a corset, and it's all 1910 or 1890s. And I like corsets on the outside. Okay? That was fun.
I'm a Madonna of you.
And you just have a couple of drinks, and then you go out for the night, and you don't have too much. I mean, a little bit is good. More is not better. Makes you a drivelling idiot. And it's fun just to try it every now and then. But the wormwood oil does not make you go mad. I wrote about it in one of my books. Look it up. It's on for free in the ABC homepage at drcarl.com, or look up GMIS, Great Moments in Science, and see absinthe in there as well.
Thanks for the call, Josh.
Thank you.
Good on you, mate. We've got time for one more from Tim in Manly. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how you going?
Good. What's your question?
My question, Dr. Carl, is regarding HAARP and Star Wars and the ionosphere.
Yep.
Basically, what I wanted to know, just if you had any opinion on whether effectiveness or not, there's a few conspiracy theories that it's causing earthquakes and this sort of thing. I just wanted to hear your take on it.
Okay, HAARP, H-A-A-R-P, is, what does that stand for? High Altitude Atmospheric Research Project or something like that. It's up in Alaska. And what they've got is a fields of antennas which send out radio waves, which hopefully can influence what's happening in the upper atmosphere. Yeah. The reason they have it up there is that there's a hole in the Earth's magnetic field at the north and the south pole. And in this case, Alaska is close enough to the north magnetic pole, that's fine, it all works. Yeah. They're doing research. I'm sure if they could find a way to turn it into a weapon, they would. Mm-hmm. We humans are like that. But at the moment, it doesn't seem as though they have. And everything else you read about is basically conspiracy theory that they set off the earthquake in and pick the most recent earthquake in whatever country of the world and insert it here. And you see the same conspiracy theories coming out. So I think it's as simple as that. They're just trying to find out more about the upper atmosphere and how they can alter it.
They are already altering it, are they not? When they are playing around with these kinds of voltages, they are changing what's going on in the ionosphere, aren't they?
Microscopically, the same way that we disturb the universe when you step on a butterfly. I really don't think we're doing major, major effects from there, and we're getting far more knowledge. And I don't think it's been weaponized. The reason I say that is that the vast, vast majority of it is just open to general scientists, and they go in there and they do their 6 months and they come out again. It's not that the whole thing is locked down and there's a secret elevator that takes you underground, and there the full laboratory is as good as the best laboratories on Earth, which we know currently are the ones in the hair product laboratories where impossibly beautiful women and handsome men walk around flashing their long blonde hair in all directions. They're the best laboratories. The second best ones are the LHC, and the third best ones are the secret underground ones at HARP, I don't think.
Hey, thanks for the call, Tim.
Right, thanks.
Good on you, mate.
Thank you, Dr. Tim.
That's about all the time we have this morning for science. Dr. Carr, we'll be back this time next week to talk science, and don't forget you can catch up with all the science goodness on the podcast, triplej.net.au. Thanks, Carr. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, and look up all the answers on Twitter. See you later.